You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear about a haunting live theater event in Green Bay, letting visitors into the mind of a creepy clown that became infamous in the city last year.
First, we learned last month that an American who was allegedly fighting for ISIS in Syria surrendered to U.S. forces and was turned over to the U.S. military. While details about the situation are hazy, we do know that the individual is being detained as a so-called enemy combatant, a term that has resurfaced after being more or less phased out during the Obama years.
The enemy combatant designation was originally used to detain suspected terrorists at length and without charges, much like what we saw in the early 2000s at Guantanamo Bay, America's detention center in Cuba. Our next guest is worried about the return of that designation and maybe an increase in the use of Guantanamo Bay. She says that represents some of the worst parts of America's war on terror.
Karen Greenberg joins us now. She's the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School. She's also the author of the book, The Least Worst Place, Guantanamo's First 100 Days and Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State. Karen, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, during the Obama administration, it seemed like the days were numbered for Gitmo. And now in your recent piece, you write that it seems as if that detention facility will have a far longer life than you imagined. What do you think has changed for Guantanamo Bay under the Trump White House?
Well, what's changed, it's changed completely in terms of the attitude coming out of the executive, out of the White House. Obama, President Obama made it clear on his first day in office that he wanted to close it. Not unlike George Bush, who wanted to close it at the end of his presidency. But Trump has made no bones about it, and neither has the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions. They would like to keep Guantanamo open, and they would like to add more individuals to it. And at one point, even mentioned that they might put an American there, or Americans there, which, of course, is not allowed or authorized under current policy. So there's a lot to worry about the future of Guantanamo. And if it had been closed, as Obama had wanted to do, it would be much harder to get something like this started again.
I'd like to play a clip from early 2016. Here's then-candidate Donald Trump talking about his future plans for Guantanamo Bay.
This morning I watched President Obama talking about Gitmo, right? Guantanamo Bay, which, by the way, we are keeping open. And we're going to load it up with some bad dudes, believe me. We're going to load it up.
So listening to that clip and knowing what we know about the state of things now, which is to say we don't know a lot so far, but have you seen President Trump moving in that direction, following through on what he said in that clip we just heard?
You know, we do know some things. We know that there's an extra large amount of money that has been appropriated for Guantanamo Bay at a time when there were only 41 detainees there, and the detainees who are standing trial for things like the 9/11 attack. So it is a very small population compared to the total amount of people that went through there, which was 800. So the idea that it needs more funding is somewhat problematic and worrisome. We've also seen that there was a specific position created, actually in the first Bush years and again throughout the Obama years, which is a position of a special envoy or ambassador for transferring those individuals who were cleared for release by a panel of reviewers to leave Guantanamo. And this is, by periodic review board, it means that individuals' cases can come up time and time again, and then the panel decides, can they be released without being considered dangerous anymore? And so when you think about it, more than 700 people have been released one way or another from Guantanamo Bay. And these envoys or ambassadors are the individuals that are charged with making transfer arrangements, which countries will they go to, under what conditions, etc. That position was ended by President Trump last month. So we have seen signs. They're more negative measures than, active measures. And also the use of the term enemy combatant is a very bad signal. While there may have been an understanding that there were individuals that could be held in military custody during the Obama administration, The other side of that understanding was that they would be questioned and then turned over to law enforcement and then tried through the federal court system. We don't have that understanding now, and the Attorney General and the President have given us signs to worry about it. There's no reason they can't tell us or shouldn't tell us the name, at least, of this individual.
We're talking to Karen Greenberg right now, director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School. She's also the author of The Least Worst Place, Guantanamo's First 100 Days. And Karen, let's talk a little bit more about the term enemy combatant. What does that entail from a legal perspective?
Well, there are lawful combatants and then there are unlawful combatants. And the term enemy combatant was originally used by the Bush administration to separate out individuals that were captured in the war on terror, whether it was in Afghanistan or on the larger global battlefield, and exempt them from certain conditions that would protect prisoners of war initially. And that's how you got this term detainee rather than prisoner. It's how you got the term enemy combatant. In the old days, we had in the beginning years of the Bush administration, there were enemy combatants on American soil as well as enemy combatants abroad. The ones on American soil were kept in military detention, but even then they were eventually turned over to the federal court system. So I feel like this term is an intentional poke in the eye. Like, we're going to go back to we're going to reinstitute these things that, people who were more civil liberties-minded didn't want. And this is just a red flag. I think it's an intentional provocation. This is a provocative president. And so I think it's time to pay attention and to pay attention very carefully to what else may be going on. There's been a lot of talk about what will happen if we capture somebody. Will we bring them into the federal court system? And that's what people are wondering about this particular American enemy combatant that has been detained somewhere abroad. But we have yet to see the Trump administration detain an individual in American custody and then put them through the court system. We have seen cases which were initiated by the Obama administration that eventually ended up bringing individuals to this country. But in terms of, new territory and new individuals, we really don't know the answer to that question, although many people have tried to make, one or two transfers to this country look like a sign of hope. I don't see that sign.
I want to take a caller on this. We have Charlie on the line from Milwaukee. Charlie, hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question is for the people that are fighting the United States in this war on terror, do they deserve the U.S. constitutional rights if they are never in the United States? And conversely, what if someone does come to the United States explicitly to promote terror within the United States? Are they also afforded constitutional rights, even though they have came?
And we lost you there, Charlie. But Karen, what do you think?
It's a really good question, and it goes to the exact heart of this controversy and this debate. The short answer is that if you're an American citizen or you are detained on U.S. soil, we have eventually, in some cases, but the country has provided the protections of the U.S. Constitution. It's not such a bad thing. It's not like these people they go to trial and that they are acquitted. They are brought to trial. They are tried. Evidence is brought up, and the evidence in these cases has proven dispositive, and they've been convicted. But that's the country that we are. It's a whole other story about what we're going to do with foreigners from abroad that try harm against us or who succeed in harming us, as happened in attacks in the 1990s abroad and has happened since then. So the answer to that question is that prior to 9/11, we always brought those individuals to the United States. We tried them, convicted them for the most part, put them in Colorado, convicted them always, put them in Colorado in the Supermax. Now that's what's up for grabs, and I think that I'd be surprised to see, although it could happen, if individuals of foreigners who have never been to this country, who are not U.S. citizens, who are detained in the war on terror abroad, are brought into the federal court system. I would be very surprised. I happen to think the federal court system is a very good way to handle this. And the reason I say that is that look at the military commissions. The military commissions have been in existence, the current ones, since 2009. When the Obama administration passed yet another new Military Commissions Act, providing, you know, different kinds of rules and regulations for the military commissions. Before those military commissions, which are housed at Guantanamo Bay and which will try some of the more high-value detainees at Guantanamo Bay, including, most importantly, those accused of being the co-conspirators in the 9/11 attacks. Look what happens when you take them out of the federal court system. They don't get tried. Don't get tried at all. Those guys are still there. And, you know, they say that the military commissions now says that they think that the 9/11 trial may begin in January of 2019. I'm sorry. It's unacceptable. One of the points of trial, in addition to bringing justice to the perpetrators, is to enable the victims to heal and to have closure. And we haven't done that for the victims of 9/11, which you could argue involved not just the families of those who were killed, but all and the friends of those who were killed, but the country at large. So it's not as if we have a lot of options. And it's always worked to bring them through the federal court system, and it seems like a viable option.
Karen, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Karen Greenberg, director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School. She's also the author of the book, The Least Worst Place, Guantanamo's First 100 Days. Gags the Clown became a notorious figure on social media last year after giving Green Bay residents a few scares during the Halloween season. Dressed in shabby clothes and holding a handful of black balloons, Gags appeared around the city several times, saying nothing and leaving witnesses with many more questions than answers.
Now, a short horror film featuring Gags is in the works, and a live theater event called Gags' Nightmare is happening this month in Green Bay, inviting visitors to step into his mind. Proceeds from the event go to the Production Farm, an organization teaching agriculture and independent filmmaking to young people in the foster care system.
Carolyn Keither is the project director for Gags Nightmare, and she co-founded the Production Farm with her husband. Carolyn, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So, Carolyn, can you tell us a little bit of the background behind Gags that led us to the event going on, Gags Nightmare, today?
Yeah, so it started a little over a year ago. Director and writer Adam Krauss came up with this brainchild that is Gags. And it started with just he released a few kind of creepy photos, kind of, you know, the blurred out photos of him in different recognizable areas downtown Green Bay. And it blew up, and everybody thought it was real. The students that we work with, they would come and talk to us and be like, I'm not going out at night. This clown is on the rampage. And we knew that it was a part of this film, and they made the short film out of it, and that got a lot of media attention and did very well in the festival circuit, which ended up greenlighting the feature film of Gags the Clown. And so we had met him at one of the film festivals, and we had already been in the works to create a haunted house for this year. And we said, let's, you know, join our efforts, collaborate. Let's, you know, can we use him kind of as our downtown Green Bay icon? And it's just been a blast working with his team and working with our students putting this together.
And this isn't your everyday Halloween haunted house. Tell us about the theater experience we'd get at Gags Nightmare.
Yeah, we started calling it a haunted house just because that was a term that was familiar to people, because to actually describe what it is unlike anything that exists, especially in this part of the world. It's more like you're entering the world of a play, and the patrons coming through, you're a part of it. You're a major part of it, and you have we have six different characters, brilliant actors that are your guide, and they walk you through and they take you through the series of hallways and rooms where you kind of dive into, you know, a creepy clown's brain. So some of it's, you know, might be part of his backstory. Part of it might be something that he remembers or his view on things. But it's super interactive and immersive theater.
Are any of the students that you work with involved in this now?
Absolutely. They have been on board since day one. We would have, creative writing sessions and say, okay, here's the idea for this room. Just let your brains explode. What do you think of this? And what do you think of that? And so they helped with all of the character development, the designs of the room, the physical building of the sets, the artwork. And now a lot of them are either acting in it or doing other things, helping with social media or running the box office. So they've been a very major key part in this whole process.
What do they like about it? It's definitely creepy. I remember I was in an airport when the gag stuff hit social media, and it definitely creeped me out from afar, even though I wasn't near Green Bay. What is the appeal for them and for you in this?
I think the creepy factor is the fact there is so much that's unknown about gags. He's not a clown that's, going around with the chainsaw and blood, guts, and gore. He's very quiet, and he just shows up in areas. And I think that unknown makes everybody feel uneasy when they see him.
And proceeds from Gag's Nightmare go to the production farm. Tell us a little bit about the production farm and what you do there.
Yeah, the Production Farm, it's a nonprofit organization, and we work with youth primarily in the foster care system, and specifically teenagers in the foster care system. And we give them an outlet to create. We use arts and independent filmmaking, also paired with farm work, to give them, we basically trick them into learning life skills and job training through a fun, creative outlet. So we're building confidence and self-worth, and also this, we're going to build a set today that's math, but they don't think it's math. They have fun with it. But at the end, if you do something wrong, you're not getting, an F on your test. You're getting, the set falls down. And, you try it again.
Well, scary clowns are kind of a thing right now. Culturally, they're having a moment. There's the movie It. There's your movie. There's been other examples of kind of copycat clowns. What do you think it is about creepy clowns that's captivating people today?
I don't know. And there's a mix of people that are like, I love to be scared, and I want to come in and enjoy this. And then we have people that are like, I will not step foot in any room or any place that has a clown in it. And maybe it's that brain, it's something in our brain that goes, okay, this is supposed to be something that's like for little kids, and it's supposed to be fun and nice. But then you add the scary element to it, and it just makes it terrifying.
You were involved in making it. Are you scared going through Gag's Nightmare?
I will say at the end of the night, there has been times when, I have forgotten something. I'll be out of my car, and I'll have to go back down, because we're in the lower level.
Man.
It's the basement level of a building. And I'll forget something, and I'll have to go back down there, and all the lights are off. And I have built every single aspect of, this place. I know it with my eyes closed, but walking through it with the lights off, I'm still like, okay, please, nobody jump out.
Wow, that sounds pretty scary, especially for me, who's a total lightweight with that. Well, Carolyn, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much.
That was Carolyn Keuther, Project Director of Gag's Nightmare, a frightening live theater event happening in Green Bay. All proceeds go to the Production Farm, teaching independent filmmaking to youth in the foster care system.
Governor Walker has been touting Wisconsin as a top 10 state and a model for the nation. He looks at statistics like Wisconsin being top 10 in high school graduation rates, student ACT test scores, a fully funded pension programs for public workers, and other economic and educational measures.
But our guest says Wisconsin's story is more complicated than that, and a lot of it depends on where you live. Economic data shows that Dane County is leading Wisconsin's economic recovery from the Great Recession, but there are lots of small towns and rural areas in the state that are still suffering, along with Milwaukee.
That's why our next guest called his two-part series for the Isthmus, The Two Wisconsins. Mark Eisen is a freelance writer, former editor of the Madison Weekly, Isthmus. Mark, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thank you.
Well, on average, Wisconsin is recovering still from the Great Recession, but that average hides a lot of differences. Can you spell out what you mean by the two Wisconsins?
Yeah, there are two parts of the state that are not doing well, and they are the parts of the state that are just totally different, and that is rural Wisconsin and urban Milwaukee. They are united in a sense that they are both areas that are left behind in terms of the economic recovery. They are not doing well. Northern Wisconsin, rural Wisconsin, is losing population. The kids are leaving there. Inner city Milwaukee is very segregated, very poor. It's not a good situation in either parts of the state there.
And you talk about the new Foxconn deal intended to boost manufacturing and jobs in Wisconsin. And you say that if you look at it from a certain way, it's actually a startling admission about entrepreneurship in the state.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have all of the facts on this, but it appears that Wisconsin outbid substantially other states to land the Foxconn contract and the assembly plant. $3 billion worth. In contrast, North Carolina, I think, bid $600,000 for the Foxconn plant. Michigan, I think, was under $2 billion. It is, you can look at it in a sense that it's almost an act of frustration in trying to get the state moving. Wisconsin ranks dead last in terms of entrepreneurial startups. This is from the Kauffman Foundation. We've been dead last for 3 straight years. We are not producing a lot of new companies. We are not doing a lot of startups. There's a lot of talk about it, not a lot of action. So you can argue that Foxconn is sort of an alternative vision on what to do, and you know, there's pros and cons to it. And one of the cons is that it's heavily invested in the old manufacturing economy. And one can raise questions about how many new jobs will come from the manufacturing economy versus the tech economy.
And that division in the state, you write, is playing out in entrepreneurship. The state isn't doing great. And what we have for entrepreneurship is really concentrated in Madison and Dane County. To a lesser extent, it looks like the Fox Cities and other small communities. But there's a huge entrepreneurship gap, basically.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting. We are not doing very well. Madison has a very strong health tech cluster of businesses, thanks obviously to Epic Systems, which is an extraordinary success. But this is true, and people talk about different reasons why we're not doing well in terms of entrepreneurial activity, lack of capital, the failure of the university. I'm not sure entirely what the answer is, but I could tell you that at the Capitol, very, very little attention is being paid to startups in the entrepreneurial community. Very little. There was a fund of funds, the Badger Fund of Funds, that was funded 3 years ago. It is for $25 million, which is quite small. It has not even made a single investment yet. There is a gap in terms of startups, especially tech startups.
And when you look at the concentration of economic growth in Dane County and some of the Fox Cities, a little bit western Wisconsin, what is the overall picture when you look at that gap with the rest of Wisconsin and you look about the future demographics-wise that the state is facing?
Well, there's some really telling detail about the depopulation of northern Wisconsin and central Wisconsin. Young people are leaving. The population is getting older and older. The projections in terms of those parts of the state is really kind of scary, in that in 15, 20 years, it's like more than 35% of the population will be over the age of 65. It's really not a good scene. There's a strong argument made in terms of growing the economy, and it's made by the folks who work at the UW Extension, and they call it placemaking, and that is trying to build communities that are attractive to young people, to young families. I think there's a lot to be said for that. Wausau has been a very good example of that. They've been written about a lot. In part, the Bonavere Band is based there and has decided to stay there, and that's been very, very important for them.
So that would be Eau Claire you're thinking of?
Right, and that's a model. That's one model of how to do it. It takes time and it takes an investment, but what the professionals say is that jobs follow people. 30 or 40 years ago, a young person would move to a city where there are a lot of jobs. Now it's almost the opposite, in that a lot of the college-educated people, they want to go to Portland, they want to go to Seattle, they want to go to Minneapolis, go to Chicago, go to Atlanta. They assume that they will go there and find jobs. This is very different from the old paradigm, and Wisconsin has to make should be making attractive communities that will pull in people like this.
Talking to Mark Eisen about his two-part series in Isthmus in Madison. It's called The Two Wisconsins, looking at the economic divisions in the state that go along with political and cultural divisions as well. And you're right, Mark. I mean, this is a big thing here in Wisconsin. It's something that's going on in the rest of the country in many ways as well.
Yeah, it's actually kind of surprising how the nature of the recovery was misapprehended by a lot of smart people. We went through the economic recession, the Great Recession, in I think from 2008 through 2010. We've had a recovery since then, but it's been very, very focused in larger communities, larger counties, tremendously so. I can read a stat from a great study that was done by the Economic Innovation Group, and they found that just 2% of the American counties accounted for 50% of the job growth in the 2010s. 2% of the counties have accounted for 50% of the job growth in the 2010s. And yeah, we're talking mostly about coastal and Sunbelt big cities. Smaller communities have actually lost businesses. They are not starting businesses. Wisconsin has been lucky in that Madison has been an outlier. Even though it's a medium-sized city, it has risen on the updraft of the tech revolution. Wisconsin is lucky that Dane County is performing so well economically. Otherwise, the state would be in bad shape.
Is the success of Dane County enough to lift the tide for the entire state, or do you need a bigger metropolitan area, more like Milwaukee?
Well, you know, this is just my opinion, but I think there has to be a targeted rural agenda. There has to be done stuff. I've talked to a fair number of lawmakers and specialists. A lot of it simply comes down to infrastructure. They really, really need better internet connections in rural Wisconsin. You need more collaboration between the tech school, the university, the business community. Milwaukee is, people don't want to face up to how heavily segregated it is in terms of race and income. It haunts Wisconsin. It haunts the metro area. It is, you know, the National Urban League has rated Milwaukee to be among the worst communities for a black person to live. You know, 30 or 40 years ago, when the factories were located in downtown Milwaukee, the hyper-segregation was not that damaging. Now, if the jobs outside of the central city, there are just so many people locked in poverty. There needs to be some sort of focused program to deal with what's going on in the inner city of Milwaukee, because I feel strongly that Wisconsin will not prosper. The Milwaukee metro area will not prosper. That's unless the city of Milwaukee does better economically.
You cite Kathy Kramer and her book in your piece, and she writes about resentment in Wisconsin, us versus them mentality. She focuses a lot on rural Wisconsin versus Madison, but there's also rural versus the big cities, regional divisions. Are we not acting like one state in trying to solve the problems you're pointing out?
Well, that's a good point. That's a good, the answer is no. But, Madison, like I live on the east side of Madison, which is a bubble by itself. We are pretty oblivious about the poverty that's in outstate Wisconsin. We don't recognize how resentful people are of all these thousands of good state jobs and benefits. We sort of live in we are disconnected to what the rest of the state thinks and feels, and there is a political parameter to this. There's a big political parameter, which I can talk about if you want a little bit. But, there needs to be, the best argument I've heard is for a regional approach, to economic development. Focus on the college campuses, the tech schools, the business communities, and do it that way.
We're talking to writer and former editor Mark Eisen now about his two-part series called The Two Wisconsins.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea of two Wisconsins? What does this look like in your community? Why do you think the Badger State is split into these different economic regions with very different paths, levels of success and economic struggle? How has your community recovered from the Great Recession? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org.
We're continuing our discussion now with writer Mark Eisen, looking at economic and political divisions here in Wisconsin.
He writes that there are two Wisconsins. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Which Wisconsin are you living in? Do you see these dividing lines, these even resentments between rural areas and the cities, rural areas and Madison? Are you in Milwaukee or these smaller communities that are still struggling to recover from the Great Recession? What could get you out of that? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And we'll go to our callers now. We've got Dennis joining us first in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi, Veronica. Okay, something that adds to the quality of life in any city, especially the little cities like I am in Two Rivers, are the retailers. But when money is spent with Amazon.com and Walmart and these other big ones, the money leaves the area. When the money is spent with the local retailers, more of it stays in the area to be reinvested.
Dennis, thank you for that. And Mark, what about focusing on the local economy, the local merchants, and keeping some of the outside, the big box stores at bay?
Well, I think that's a real good point. It's a very good point. The problems that sometimes when people are hard-pressed on money, they need to buy the cheapest product they can, and that puts them at the big boxes or puts them online with Amazon. But certainly supporting local business is very important.
Thanks a lot for that call. I want to get back to manufacturing. You write, and you talk to a lot of people who say, we are thinking in old ways with our focus on manufacturing. It was the wave of the past. It may not be the road to the future.
Yeah, that's a real tough one. I'll tell you, it is. It's hard. I mean, Wisconsin was the center of manufacturing in the U.S., and we, especially southeastern Wisconsin, it made people very, very prosperous, very democratic in the sense that that there wasn't a lot of poverty. The recession in the 1980s entirely changed the game, and that's when the Rust Belt started to kick in, and so many small towns in Wisconsin and the Midwest and in the East suffered badly as jobs left the city. We are still a big manufacturing state. It's still important, but it's not an area where we are adding a lot of jobs. But yet our policies at coming out of the Capitol are heavily tilted towards more inducements to manufacturers, including just a hugely costly tax credit, which will cost the state literally hundreds of millions of dollars a year, that probably is not going to produce a whole lot of jobs. Yeah, that's a problem.
Mark, before we get to another caller, which I want to do, I want to ask you about a quote from your piece. You call Wisconsin old and unadventurous. Can you flesh out what you mean by that?
Well, the data on this is really interesting. The data is that that Wisconsin has some of the oldest companies in the nation. I do not have it at my fingertips right now, but we are among probably the five worst states for having the oldest average age of a company. These companies are very good at what they do. They've been doing it for decades. The problem is that they're not very good at innovation. That's a big problem with that. The other thing is that we rank very high for homies, for people who are born and raised in Wisconsin are still there. It's like more than 70% of the people who live in Wisconsin were born here. And, you know, why is that? Whereas other states that are growing very, very, very quickly and are dynamic have less than 50%, states like Washington and Colorado and California. That's because people are streaming into those states. Wisconsin is not attracting a lot of new people, especially young college-educated people. We are kind of like, you know, I use the line, they're like, the Wisconsin economy is like the it's like an old Oldsmobile. It's got a very smooth ride, but it's old, and the 8-track doesn't work anymore.
We're talking to Mark Eisen about his pieces, a two-part series, The Two Wisconsins, looking at economic divisions here in the state. Back to your calls now with Susan on the line in Menominee. Susan, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Susan?
Well, I've been listening to the conversation, and I am not someone who was born and raised in Wisconsin. I'm from Minnesota, but I've lived here for a number of years, and I've really loved it. The people, it's beautiful here. I've liked it a lot, but I do notice, I think, a stark difference in terms of that divide between the rural and the more urban. And I live in more rural right now, and there is a lot of resentment. And I lived in rural areas in Minnesota and did not experience anything on that level. I also am concerned about what I'm seeing. I've wondered if this is going to be a place to stay long term for me, even though I would like to. But an example is a little town south. I am in the Menominee area. There's a little town just south called Durand that I have. I drive through down their main street about once every couple weeks on my way south. And when I moved here about 10 years ago, that was a thriving community that reminded me of my hometown, about 2,000 people in Minnesota. Had a movie theater, had a thriving business area downtown, and what I've seen in the last few years is businesses closing.
And Susan, I want to jump in because we're getting a little short on time. Mark, I think there are a lot of people living in smaller communities seeing, hey, the theater's not there anymore. The business that I used to go to, the restaurant, they've closed.
Yes, there's a depopulation going on in northern Wisconsin, in small town Wisconsin. I would love to see for our next gubernatorial campaign that the candidates, both Governor Walker and the Democrats, come up with a platform to help rural Wisconsin and urban Milwaukee.
Let's take another caller. Thank you for that one, Susan. We'll go next to Frank in Kenosha. Hi, Frank.
Hi. Very fascinating show. Great topic. You know, down in Kenosha, we almost feel like we're in a third Wisconsin, because we're only 1 hour from Chicago, and we were quite urban down here. I mean, at one point, American Motors Corporation employed over 20,000 people, and when they left, people basically thought that Kenosha was going to fold. But because of our proximity to Illinois, and I think something like 25,000 people a day plus are commuting down to Illinois for work, it's kind of transformed the whole area. And you even see it in things like the football teams, where you'll get, like, you know, half Packers and half Bears fans.
Thank you for that, Frank. And he's seeing a third Wisconsin where Kenosha is almost a satellite of Chicago. How does that factor in?
Well, that's a really smart observation. I was raised in Kenosha County, and my family came from Chicago, so I know exactly what he's talking about. There's a good argument that's made for doing regional economic development where you actually emphasize the connection to Chicago in southeastern Wisconsin, in the same way in western Wisconsin that you emphasize the connection to Minneapolis-St. Paul. That's what smart economic development would include. And, for example, that train sure would have helped.
Mark, thanks for that call. And, Mark, thanks so much for coming up to the studio today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Mark Eisen. He's a freelance writer and former editor of the Madison Weekly Isthmus. You can find a link to the two-part series we've been talking about today. It's called The Two Wisconsins. That's linked at WPR.org. You can also go to the Ideas Network Facebook page and let us know what your Wisconsin looks like if your community has recovered from the Great Recession. The second installment of his piece, by the way, comes out tomorrow in Isthmus.